I'm Ryan Halford, and I love craniosacral therapy. From the theory, to the practice, to the people, there's always something in cranial work that fuels a sense of adventure in my life. I'd like to share that adventure with you on the Craniosacral Podcast. Hello, my craniosacral friends. Welcome to episode 61 of the podcast that keeps you in touch with the people and ideas that shape the world of craniosacral therapy. I'm feeling quite good today. It was a very busy week in the clinic, and I'm grateful for that. I had an unusually long lull in my clinic numbers in the middle of the summer this year, but it seems that things are picking back up again. So that certainly makes life better in the financial department. Takes a little stress off there, although it has been a lot of time and work in the clinic. But I hope your practice is doing well and serving a healthy purpose in your life. I hope you're getting the numbers that you are looking for and that you need to be comfortable and pursue the things that you like to do. All right. Before we get going with our interview today, I'd like to follow up on what I mentioned in last episode and remind you I'll be joining Body Intelligence for a couple foundation trainings in Vancouver, Canada, and then Austin, Texas, both of which are going to be starting up here pretty soon. And I will also be continuing classes in the northeastern United States, including some offerings in classical craniosacral work that are coming up in the fall. And, also going to be bringing Michael Shea back to Austin towards the end of the year for some more cardiovascular training. So, if you're looking to get in the classroom, please keep me in mind. You can see my schedule at cranioschool.com, and that is usually updated. Sometimes I'm a little bit slow to get my up-and-coming classes on there, but I try to keep up with that. I'm pretty good, so. All right, so let's get on to the good stuff for today. Today we're going to have an interview with Michael Morgan from the Upledger Institute. Now, I'm stoked to be bringing on a member of the Upledger community, as we have been pretty heavy into the biodynamic community for quite some time now. And so Michael's going to talk with us about Alzheimer's disease and dementia and help us better understand the nature of this family of diseases and also share with us what he has learned about the application of craniosacral work to these types of issues. So we'll talk some about his research in the area, his clinical experience working with these problems, his book on dementia and cranial work, and much more. So this is an information-rich episode that I think many of you will find very useful and give you some practical knowledge. Now, as always, you can find more information and links to resources mentioned in the interview on the craniosacralpodcast.com homepage. There's also an Amazon link to purchase Michael's book there. I'd really appreciate it if you would use that link, because a small portion of your purchase comes back to support the podcast if you buy through that link. It's not much, but it adds up to help out with some of the expenses on putting this show on. All right, well, let's get to it now, and we'll spend some time with Mr. Michael Morgan. Enjoy. Okay, everyone. I am here with Michael Morgan. I've been aware of Michael's work for quite some time. He got really active on the internet when the internet was young and had some videos put up quite some time ago. And his practice has really developed into a bit of a specialization within our work. And I think talking with him today is going to be really, really neat and educational for some of us to learn more about Alzheimer's and dementia. So, Michael, why don't you take some time and give all our listeners an idea of your background, how you got into cranial work with Dr. John, et cetera, and kind of set us up for our topic to talk about today.
Great. Well, thanks for having me this morning. A little bit about my background. I've been teaching cranial sacral for about 20 years, and I got involved in the early 90s. Like a lot of people, I had no idea I was going to get involved in this thing called cranial sacral therapy, and I just kind of, by accident, got exposed to it and started practicing and did it. And I kind of joke with some of my friends, I got to cranial sacral by practicing with another person and created a whole practice before I even went to my first class. So being an entrepreneur, I did it completely backwards. So, but then I found, as all of us have, I think that I really got to get some great results. And in the early years in the 90s, I was fortunate enough to be down at the Institute and work with Dr. Upledger and work at the Upledger Clinic, like a lot of people have. And really from that experience with Dr. John, I learned a lot about how to do research, because I would watch Dr. John come in every Wednesday afternoon and work with clients. There was one big room in the clinic and six tables, and there'd be anyone from a six-month-old child to an 80-year-old man, and they would all work in the same room. So talk about the experience of learning group consciousness. And I would watch Dr. Upledger as he came in and see how he would practice and work on the newest things he was working on. Like, we would be sitting across from each other, and he'd go, like, Mike, I just was talking about chaperone cells and how they have an influence on cancer and how cancer can be caused by the meltdown of stress in the body. And I would watch him kind of use the intensive program almost like his R&D laboratory. And really from him, I learned how he got up early in the morning, which of course I don't always do, but he'd get up in the morning, write, and then he would treat, and then he would teach. And just like Jean-Pierre Barral and others, really watched how he created a system for learning the next step. So that was very valuable to work with him. And as I started teaching in the late 90s, pretty much, you know, I would work on the standard range of folks. I worked a lot with kids, worked a lot with babies, kids with autism, cerebral palsy, that kind of thing. And funnily enough, working with kids really taught me a lot about how to work with seniors, because they're the two most vulnerable parts of the population, you know. So yeah, that was good. So you could see how those two things really apply to each other. And sometime in early 2000, my stepmother and sister-in-law developed Alzheimer's and actually died of the disease. And that's what got me thinking about cranial sacral therapy and its application to memory and dementia. As a lot of people are interested, it's because they've been touched by this disease in one way or another. And I thought, well, look, you know, we've had some good results with cranial sacral therapy with closed-end injuries in kids, like I said, with autism, cerebral palsy, that kind of thing, immune system disorders, which I know Tim has spoken a lot with about, and we've collaborated on some things. And so I also thought, well, maybe this could have some applicability to prevention and perhaps even reversal of Alzheimer's dementia. So that's how I kind of blundered into the subject and started to do research to see how all of the dots were connected in terms of Alzheimer's dementia and how possibly cranial sacral therapy could prevent this disease. And it's interesting we're talking right now because we're right on the edge of a little bit of a proof of concept idea in terms of our intensive to see if we can actually move things forward even more. So it's a kind of a key turning point in terms of therapy and getting this out to the public, because, of course, all the therapists know how cranial sacral therapy can be effective. But what I'm trying to do is get this information out also to the 100 million people in the U.S., that are 50 years or over, and all the people worldwide where we think this can really help. So this is revolutionary in a sense to say that we can take what's really the third major cause of disease in the United States, not the sixth major cause, but the third major cause. There are some reasons for those numbers. And say, you know, we can really make a difference. So that's pretty exciting to take that leap, as exciting as we've done with, you know, the vet program, and also what we've done with the concussion program. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of a background in terms of where I've been, and it's just been a very exciting and continuing journey as I've done this.
Yeah. So I just finished looking through your book, The Body Energy Longevity Prescription, How Cranial Sacral Therapy Helps Prevent Alzheimer's and Dementia While Improving the Quality of Your Life. Can you tell us more about the nature of this disease we are talking about. You know, I have had very little actual clinical experience working with people that have had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia. So I'm really interested, and I found your book really interesting, to learn more about the nature of the disease. Can you fill us in more about what's happening with the body, how we are diagnosed with this?
Well, what I found, quite accidentally, I worked from the brain and worked backwards to the body. Because what occurred to me, first of all, is there was some mechanism of brain inflammation that probably really encouraged the formation of these amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in the brain. And when we look at all the immune system work that we've done, that Suzanne's spoken about and Tim, we know that inflammation is somewhat ubiquitous these days, and it can start in the body and then overflow into the brain. So what I did quite by accident, I was looking at, okay, how can cranial sacral help with brain inflammation? And I knew from our concussion studies and brain injury that we'd gotten some good results. And then one day, this is the story I always tell, I was doing my two-day class for prevention of Alzheimer's dementia just for lay people, where people can learn a simple cranial sacral still point and cranial sacral pumping in 2 days. And I was out in Southern California years ago, and I met with a guy from the Southern California, on the Southern California board of the Alzheimer's Association. And he said to me, you know, Mike, about 40% of people in an Alzheimer's unit have diabetes. And I said, I didn't know that. So I started to look at the connections, and Tim Hutton was very kind and gentle about it. He says, well, you know, Mike, you might want to look at a guy named Mark Hyman, who's, of course, on the forefront of functional medicine, and look and see how that applied, because a lot of functional medicine doctors were starting to call Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I took a year to get around to reading the book, and then I read the book, and then I looked at all the inflammatory processes that he spoke about, took his quiz, and I realized, oh, not only does this apply to my patients, it applies to me, too. Mm-hmm. So I started again on the paleo diet and, you know, lost about 20 pounds and found, oh, indeed, maybe inflammation in the body has something to do with weight gain, and really changed my blood numbers and did some tests. I've been working with a functional medicine doctor now for years and really realized, oh, yeah, this can shift. But I had to kind of do the work on myself to realize what was happening. Yeah. And then as I researched even further, I realized that when people get Alzheimer's, and in a way this isn't rocket science, but it's just connecting the dots, that many, many people that have Alzheimer's just don't wake up one day, like a lot of older people you talked about, they're afraid they're going to get Alzheimer's, like catch the flu or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's not like you just wake up one day with Alzheimer's, because actually a lot of what I call the diseases of aging, which are inflammatory in nature, are brewing for decades before it happens. So diabetes is just one. And, of course, if you're eating too much sugar, and, you know, sugar in normal levels is fine, but in concentrations it's really toxic. That can create inflammation in the body. It raises insulin level. And what happens, as Tim says, is that when you have insulin resistance in the brain, which mirrors the body, then what happens is that it's as if the brain is drowning in a sea of plenty. You know, the brain will use about 60% of all the glucose in the body, and it can't absorb it. And piled high and deeper over and above that, that can contribute to inflammatory processes in the brain. So then I started to realize, when I looked at the health history and some of the initial research that we'd done that was published in the American Journal of Gerontological Nursing in 2008, I realized, wow, a lot of people had had diabetes, or they had cardiac problems, or they might have had osteoporosis or arthritis. Anything with an itis after the name means an inflammation, of course. And any laundry list of other symptoms that may have been brewing with someone for 10 or 20 or 30 or more years. And I realized then that what was happening is the inflammation in the body starts to overflow into the brain. And fortunately, not in all cases, but enough that it's significant. And I realized we really had a growing health care crisis, because then I researched and found out there's about 79 million people in the States that are pre-diabetic, and about another 20 to 25 million that are officially diabetic. So sum those numbers together, you got 100 million people that are at risk. And they're younger. They're not just in their 60s or 70s. They might be in their 40s and 50s, even their 30s. So on the bottom of this pyramid, you have all these people hurtling towards the apex of what can contribute to inflammatory diseases in the brain. So when you look at that, even though the American Alzheimer's Association said there's no known cure for Alzheimer's, you realize, you know, all the precursors are pointing, whether it's diet, which is maybe half the picture, but then you fold in things like concussions, closed head injury, car accidents, of course, emotional trauma, and so on and so forth. And then you realize, wow, these are all contributors which have an influence on the development of the disease. And, of course, as we know as cranial therapists, it's not just one size fits all. It's not just one thing. Some people can be a combination of different symptoms. So somebody can have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia, and it can look like, smell like, feel like Alzheimer's, just like with autism. But it could be a combination of factors that feed into it. Sometimes diet is a big piece, sometimes a small piece. Sometimes people, as in a recent patient I'm looking at, they had a toboggan accident and they fell 15 feet off a cliff and their lower back was shattered. And the doctors just said, well, let's leave the back as it is and see if it heals up. I think that's a major contributor to his dementia right now. So you can see how things can be interconnected. So, you know, I looked at that and realized that inflammatory processes in the body can contribute to brain inflammation. And that's part of the piece I looked at in terms of how Alzheimer's developed. And then I started to look with that at some exciting new science, brain science, and realized how cranial sacral therapy can help. So I'll just take a breath there if you want to ask some more questions. That's a bit of a background.
Right. So people are familiar with the symptomology of Alzheimer's. People losing their memory would be the most famous one of all these. Tell us more about the physical mechanism in the brain that's causing this. There are plaque forming, plaques forming, correct? Tell us a little bit more about that process.
Well, and this is something I did a TED Talk last year, just about a year ago today. And I had 7 minutes to explain cranial sacral therapy, cerebral spinal fluid, inflammation, and Alzheimer's dementia. So, like, how do you do that in 7 minutes?
Yeah.
So I use the analogy of a river. It's like you have a river and it's flowing freely, and then the water table lowers and the river flows less freely. And then maybe if the river dries up, all the mud and sludge and silt begins to dry up. And in the brain, that's equivalent to a lack of flow of cerebral spinal fluid. And when you have a lack of flow, then all that's an opportunistic situation where all the amyloid plaque and neurofibrillary tangles form. Now, there's another piece that allowed me to put these pieces together, because in early 2000, Dr. Upledger wrote an article in Massage Therapy Magazine, and he commented that people in middle age, whatever that means now, because as we get older, middle age, the number keeps kind of moving later. But he said that people in middle age, their flow of cerebral spinal fluid is half that of a normal adult. And generally speaking, as we teach in cranial classes, the flow of cerebral spinal fluid can be anywhere, looking at the documentation, from 400 to 800 milliliters a day. It's what's called replacement volume or turnover. Given that we feel that there's maybe 125 milliliters or 4 fluid ounces of cerebral spinal fluid in the spinal cord in the brain at any time, so that there's a normal turnover. So what happens, and fortunately a lot of doctors will even agree with this part, you will see not uncommonly as people reach middle age, let's say, for example, 60 and on, maybe sometimes even 50, they can actually see in an MRI that the brain starts to shrink. And I showed this picture in my TED Talk of a normal brain and an Alzheimer's brain, which looks a little bit like a shriveled up walnut. You can see one side and then the other. Well, what we found in my nurse practitioners that helped me with the initial study on people with mid to late stage dementia is that when people have senile dementia, their flow of cerebral spinal fluid is 75% less than a normal adult. So it might go from 800 milliliters a day, to use round numbers, to 200. So that's the analogy of the river. That flow of cerebral spinal fluid is less, and that creates a situation where more and more toxins of the type like the amyloid plaque and neurofibrillary tangles form. Now, what's really exciting is there's some new science to really back up what we're talking about. And this is the discovery, and Tim may have talked about this, and another one of my associates, Ted Van Veer, has done some great work on this. That's about the discovery of the glymphatic system.
Yeah.
And a group of scientists actually won a Nobel Prize a few years ago for looking at this. And it's basically saying there is a system inside the brain. As you know, glymph means glue, like glial cells, and lymphatic means lymphatic system. And they found out there's a more effective way for the brain to drain toxins than we ever believed. And they look at this, and I think what's brilliant about Dr. Upledger is that even in the 70s and 80s, he had this pressure stat model, which explained this mechanism and model of how cerebral spinal fluid is pumped in the brain and down the spinal cord and back again. But the technology has advanced in the last few years to say we can image how this lymphatic system works. And some professors, Nekegaard and Professor Illich at University of Rochester, and you can see one of these tapes on my website and also through the Upledger Institute, he gives a little talk on the glymphatic system and its relationship to Alzheimer's dementia. And basically, he's using that river analogy, and he's saying, what happens when there's a lack of flow of cerebral spinal fluid? He says, we feel that this is creating and encouraging these deposits of these solutes, like these amyloid plaques, in the brain. And this is totally independent of what we're doing. And then he suggests in this video that, you know, if we could find a way to increase the flow of cerebral spinal fluid to near normal levels, perhaps we could wash away these plaques and tangles. Kind of like if, and I'm not a great dishwasher, but say you have a dish and you have a black speck on it and you really wash it really hard, that's equivalent to washing away the plaques. Or if you go like through a car wash and you get the nozzle right up against a real, you know, stubborn speck and it washes this out. So he's suggesting quite independently, if we can increase the flow of cerebral spinal fluid to near normal levels, perhaps we can actually get some results. And of course, cranial sacral therapy is a great answer for that, because we found, at least through anecdotal evidence, that we can increase the flow of cerebral spinal fluid and wash those toxins away. And this, especially two techniques, the still point and cranial pumping, which are very, very basic, can help do that. And that's a little bit of the theory I'm developing to really support the results, which are exciting. I want to share with you some of the results we've seen from people too. But that's a little bit of the theory. And what I'm starting to do is speak at conferences around the world to say, this is our model. And based on what other scientists are saying independently about the glymphatic system, if MDs and researchers and therapists realize that, we have a whole other way to look at possibly certainly preventing, but even reversing the disease, which is quite a claim to say we can actually reverse a disease process. But I know that to be true, because we would not have had the kind of results we've had with concussion studies had we not been able to affect brain repair. Because that's not just prevention, that's actually a trauma in the brain, CTE, chronic traumatic encephaly, that Dr. Vincent Amalu spoke about in that movie Concussion. If you haven't seen that movie with Will Smith, watch that movie, because what Vincent Amalu did that Will Smith played is said, look, there are structures in the brain that you can't really tell till you do an autopsy, unfortunately, that say that, you know, there's trauma in the brain. And when we worked with people like Ricky Williams and NFL players, we found we've actually gotten some very good functional results and improvements. So how do you explain that? There has to be some mechanism of brain repair and increased fluid flow that that helps affect that.
Can you tell us about this study that you did, how it was structured, what techniques you utilized, and some of the results that you saw? I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, this was a study that fortunately I had some clients that were retired professors of nursing at University of Iowa. And we got to talking about the still point, and she looked at how they'd use shunts in the brain to increase fluid flow and what that could do. And I said, well, you know, we have this technique called a still point, and we think that this is going to help expand the flow of cerebrospinal fluid. So what we did was a very simple study, and it was really designed to look at agitation, because in nursing homes, people with dementia, just like people with close injuries, they have a lot of problem with agitation,
yeah,
especially late in the afternoon. So we took a very small, a dozen or so people in a pilot study in nursing homes, both in Iowa and Minneapolis. And I was the consultant for the study. We had other people actually doing the statistics and all, and I had trained some of the other therapists that were working on the patients. And they were basically people with mid to late stage dementia. And basically all we did, is do a still point and some cranial pumping that I added in every day for 10 minutes at the same time for 6 weeks. And we didn't see much change for about 3 weeks. Hmm. And then we started to see the change. And that's interesting in terms of what I've been learning about the mechanism. So what we found is that people all of a sudden started to recognize their caregivers and even their loved ones. We had a 100-year-old lady in a nursing home that started to feed herself and speak in complete sentences. And we saw other functional gains. And the way we set up the study, we did it before, during, and after test. There are certain protocols that we use to say, what is the baseline? So we looked at that. And then we did the study, and we found out even after the follow-up, the intervention, as we call it, of the still point, the techniques lasted even for a few weeks even after the intervention. And as one of my nurse practitioners, and I'm not really a statistician, but she said, Mike, this has both clinical and statistical significance, that people were shifting. So since that time, as I've been teaching other therapists in my longevity class how to do these techniques and other advanced techniques, I've started to interview the therapists, because not only have I been doing a lot of radio interviews, I want to do something on TV. And on TV, you need B-roll. You know, you need to have actual footage of people getting the results. So as I've been collecting this data, it's been very exciting, because I found the therapists working independently are getting basically the same progression. And at first I thought, and I know this sounds a little long-winded, but I thought, why is it taking so long? I mean, 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. But what the therapist was doing was working 10 to 15 minutes a day. And then I realized, well, wait a minute, Mike. Basically, Alzheimer's, like autism, is like brain injury. And the brain is carrying a very toxic load. In fact, pharmaceutical researchers call amyloid plaque, they call it amyloid load, which you can take a radioactive dye and image, and you can actually see this metallic type of aspects of the plaque in the brain. So they call it amyloid load. And I realized that it's probably a good thing it's gradual, just like it does with autism, because people that are carrying this level of mid to late stage dementia, where they lose their car keys, they get lost, they get disoriented, family's starting to think, you know, we've really got to do something about it. Those are all reflecting of symptoms of mid-stage Alzheimer's before they're just completely needing 24-hour care in late stage. So I realized that it takes the brain some time to gradually detox. And cranial sacral therapy, as we know, is gentle enough that it allows this reversal and progression to occur at that stage. And funnily enough, very much like you see in kids with autism, where there's a speech deficit, what we found is that that's paralleled with Alzheimer's as well. Is at first, when people start to degenerate, they lose aspects of speech, memory, organization, recall. And of course, it's very much reflected in speech, because they can't talk, they can't add numbers, they can't recall. And as they start to regain their function, it may come just like with an autistic kid. They might get a one word first after a lot of work, then two words. Then they start to put together complete sentences. And when you think about that, that's quite remarkable that somebody can recapture function in that way. And so what I found with therapists since then is, like, I had a gal that took my longevity course in Edmonton, Canada, last year. And I met with her in March. And I recorded her work, and what she did is she went, and she said, I didn't have any more time than to work on my mom 15 or 20 minutes a day. So she started to do that, and she worked 5 or 6 days for about 8 weeks. It didn't see much. So this is not like a, you hit it a lick and it, you know, it takes some persistence, mm-hmm. right? But after 8 weeks, she started to say, this is what happened. When she first started, her mom was in the nursing home just sitting in the dark, pretty much just gone. And after 8 weeks, as she started to have conversations with her mom started to realize she was repeating things. Because like people with close-in injuries and Alzheimer's, they will repeat a lot. And then she started to catch herself, and she realized, you know what? I think I just said that 3 times. And her daughter says, yeah. And then she started to catch herself and not repeat. And then she started to have conversations with her mom so that her mom would start to independently have conversations without cueing, which is what a lot of people need. Like I had a recent client, they need a lot of reminding. They go, oh yeah, I remember now. So her mom started to have independent conversations, like field independent conversations. And then she would go back after about 4 months and visit her mom in the nursing home. The mom wouldn't even be in the room. She'd be out in the dining hall talking to other people.
Wow.
Which is quite remarkable. Like, what is the mechanism of neurological repair that occurs? So in my most recent class I taught in Palm Beach at the Institute, I had a lady that had gone and worked with her mom, who was someone in the same shape, slipping sometimes in the late stage where she just simply wasn't there. Worked on the mom for 4 days, about 8 hours a day. And basically, without this therapist even knowing the report that I just gave you on this other therapist, she basically saw the same patterning of recover, only in a faster time. So I have been doing these mini intensives where I'll work on clients with multiple hands for 2 hours, 3 days in a row. I've been doing that for about 2-3 years now around the country. But it never occurred to me that maybe if we had a full-on intensive like we've done out at the Institute, 5 days from 10 to 5, and worked on a patient, that maybe we could actually accelerate the process even more quickly. Of course, accelerate quickly are the same word, but it's the idea of how exciting that would be. And I realized just last night that, you know, what we've always done with cranial sacral therapy is we've done certain studies which are a little bit of a demonstration project where we show the tipping point. Like I think it was in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, we did this Vietnam vet study. Mm-hmm. And we had people at the Institute work on Vietnam vets for 2 weeks. And we had people from all over the country. And we filmed the whole thing, documented it. And that really set the stage for all the work we've been doing with vets since then, where we look at traumatic brain injury from combat, depressurization and pressurization from, you know, incendiary devices like that. And have really shown that we've gotten some good results. But it was that initial study that we did down in Florida that kind of set the stage for getting people aware that, you know, cranial sacral can work with that. And then another example, a study I was fortunate enough to be involved with, is the original NFL concussion study with Ricky Williams. And Ricky, you know, sent out invitations to hundreds of people. And he had 5 people come, NFL players. And we got a lot of very talented therapists together from around the country, people that also did visceral manipulation, and worked on these athletes for a whole week. And we were fortunate enough to do a study as well as the filming of the whole thing. That set the stage to show that, you know what, cranial sacral therapy can be effective with concussions. A little bit different mechanism of brain injury than Alzheimer's, but nevertheless, it showed that progression. And out of that, now we're starting to speak at conferences around the country because people realize, oh, this cranial sacral therapy that we hadn't heard about and concussions can be effective. So looking at that, I realized after hearing about the experience of one of my students with Alzheimer's that what I want to do next, and I put this together in a rather impromptu way, on September 8th through 12th of this year, I'm actually going to do a 5-day long-term intensive where I live here in Fairfield, Iowa. And I'd love to have therapists come and participate with this. And basically, we're going to get a team of therapists together and get one gentleman who has mid-stage dementia, and sometimes the symptoms show even late stage, and see what we can do in 5 days. See if we can actually start to roll back some of the symptoms in a concentrated way. Because wouldn't it be exciting to say, we can say someone with mid-stage dementia and actually have some significant change, which we can document in their symptoms. I think that would be pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah.
So an American Alzheimer's Association, who's a little bit more medical model, let me put it like that, kindly, they say there's no known cure for Alzheimer's, which is true. But when you look at the mechanism of something that's non-invasive, non-pharmaceutical, that's adjunctive to medication, that's fine, but it can be complementary to it. But if we could accelerate and change that. So in a way, what I'm doing is borrowing from my friend Tammy Goldstein, she's done a lot of work with autism as a housewife from New Jersey that went out in this campaign and has taught a lot of people about autism. And she has created this concept called functioning recovery. And the idea with functioning recovery is that you can actually bring somebody back and stabilize the downward slide, so to speak, and then start to bring things back the other way and get enough improvement of symptoms that functioning recovery means that with the right support from diet and exercise, cranial sacral therapy and other modalities, that with that, then people can have actually a functional life. Now, no one, as far as I know in the Alzheimer's community, has ever even posited that that's possible, that you could actually have functioning recovery. You can bring somebody back from the downward slide, stabilize it, and bring it back the other way. That's quite revolutionary. It's a whole new paradigm. Mm-hmm. We're looking at introducing to the nursing and senior community. So I'm pretty excited about that. I mean, that's going out a little bit on a limb, but fortunately we're not starting from scratch. You know, we've done work on all sorts of different modalities, from inflammatory diseases to children, and gotten some good results. We're just pioneering a new level. And it's a little bit, in terms of that, a similar mechanism, but we're looking to see, almost like a demonstration project, if we can look at the rollback and see what happens, see what works.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how you're going about treating? Are you doing like a traditional CV4 for a still point induction? Are you working from other parts of the body? Are you still pointing in extension or inflection? How are you going about this?
All of the above. Okay. So let me break it down. It's very simple. That's what I teach in the two-day class for lay people. First, a still point wherever you can get on the body. People with Alzheimer's, kind of like with kids with autism, sometimes they don't like being touched at the head. They'll swat you away.
Yeah.
Get on the head, so much the better, just a standard still point. But if you can't do it there, do it at the legs, anywhere on the body you can induce a still point in the traditional way. And what we found, which is I think another reason, Ryan, why it takes a little while to get people where they're at, is when you put your hands on with someone with autism, depending on, you know, their other symptoms, their system will feel just very locked up. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like a lot of morbidity. So the more still points you can give, even 15 minutes of those, the more you can get the system moving. And that's the other concept of the cranial pumping. Wherever you can do the cranial pumping, you know, classically it's done at the head, but anywhere you can follow flexion extension and follow in both the endpoint of flexion and extension, you can get that effect as well. So anywhere you can do the cranial pumping, that can allow the system to kind of just get things moving. And it's the same thing with still point, because the whole theory is that the more flow of cerebral spinal fluid you have, the better. So that is one of the starting points of this. And Dr. Upledger spoke about this years ago when he developed this class on reversal of the pathogenic process. He started to really look at, it was just brilliant, a lot of things that Dr. Upledger did. He said, you know what? He said, I think in the body, as well as the brain, what can happen a lot of time is that there are pockets of inflammation. He called them pro-inflammatory cytokines or cytokines. And he said, wouldn't it be great if we can reduce their influence in the body? Because he thought there was like a whole pattern of them that may be hooked up in the body and influence the brain. So, of course, as we know from cranial sacral therapy, the head is connected to the body. Like I read that in a book, right? So we want to look at the influence of all those factors. So doing things like direction of other energy and other advanced techniques I talk about, if you can have when someone is arcing, if they know that technique, and they find hot spots or energetic pockets in the body and in the brain, they can do direction of energy to help actually reduce that those inflammatory pockets, which help basically reduce this process as well. So basically, even if you have 15 or 20 minutes, and start with a still point and cranial pumping and direction of energy, you're going to start to get some reversal, or at least maybe halt the progress. But of course, consistency is key. If you can get somebody to put their head on a still point inducer, if they can remember, that's the challenge, then that will help. Certainly that will help if they're worried in terms of prevention. But if they're a little further along during doing the actual hands-on technique, what I'm trying to promote is what I call longevity support group. So if people are trained like in a two-day training, then they can come to a local therapist's office and work on themselves at no cost or just a few dollars contribution, so they can actually work on themselves. And of course, if there's a trained therapist and they want to get more extensive treatment, that would be great as well. Mm-hmm. So really what I want to do is train therapists to be able to go into nursing homes and apply it there with some more advanced training, so they can be vetted going to nursing homes. Because in nursing homes, and I know this is a little bit of an aside, they're very interested in occupancy. And the baby boomers like myself, we don't want to age in the same way, you know, that our parents did. So they're looking for alternatives, and that's putting pressure on the senior care community to come up with something different.
Good.
So applying these techniques can be valuable. But what we want to do is have enough evidence for people to say, you know, maybe we should take a look at this. Maybe there's something here, there's something to this. And the theory and the science is there. The practical clinical applications is anyone that's had a good experience in treating Alzheimer's dementia, I'd love them to contact me, because I'd like to interview them specifically on their progress. So anyway, that's a little bit of an answer to what you said.
Do you have any other studies or research projects going on or going to be coming up in the future?
Here's the gold standard project, which unfortunately would take about $500,000. That's why I haven't done it. I don't have that in my spare change. But basically, I think one of the gold standards would be, and you need an MRI to do this, is that this amyloid plaque that I mentioned that accumulates in the brain, if we could image before and after, say, do a study of about 30 people, ideally, really 60 people, about 30 people we do cranial sacral therapy and about 30 people in a control group. If we could do a before study of their brain imaging, and then do cranial sacral therapy for 6 months and come back and do another follow-up and see if there's been, reduction of amyloid plaque, then I think we'd have people standing up around the block. We'd have people very seriously interested. That would be a study that would show physiologically there is some shift or change. So that's a long-term study that I'm actually starting to work with some of my therapists to say, can we get funding to do a study like that? I'm thinking of doing it maybe in Australia, because MRIs are a little cheaper there, for example. We need a venue where we can show that and a team of people. And as I did in the initial study, science, as I found, it's not just all white lab coats and clipboards. There's some politics to science, because people want to get credit for what they've done, understandably. Mm-hmm. But to put a study like that together would be a bit of coordination, but that would really be ideal to show. And as part of this, and this is more anecdotal, what I like to do long-term is do more of these five-day intensive programs, very much like we've done with UpLedger for years, and say, look, if we can take people with Alzheimer's dementia at a certain stage and do intensive therapy from like 10 to 5 every day for 5 days and start to see if we can roll back the symptoms, that's going to get us even more attention to be able to present to people and have people seriously start to take a look at that. So that's what we're on the edge of right now after about 10 years of just getting the word out and pioneering what we've done.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about the classes you have been developing for UI? You just have two official classes at this point, or how's that going?
Yeah, I have a two-day class called Cranial Sacral Therapy for Longevity, Applications for Prevention.
Okay.
And Applications for Dementia. They're really the same class, where it's a two-day class where people learn the basics of how to do a still point and direction of energy, cranial pumping, and they can learn a 15-minute or a 30-minute protocol. So this is perfect for healthcare practitioners to get familiar with our work, as well as lay people. So anyone can do this to introduce as an entry-level course. And then a few years ago, I also created a four-day class called Cranial Psychotherapy for Longevity, Reversal of the Aging Process. So it looks at these mechanisms of Alzheimer's dementia in a more detailed way, but also looks at the aspect of longevity itself, like how can we maintain ourselves to remain well and healthy. And it's a four-day examination of how to do that, so somebody can really be more of a certified longevity specialist. And I've been doing that for a few years. I taught this course last year in Moscow. I've been to Moscow 5 times now because in Moscow, they don't really have a healthcare system per se. And so the doctors, which are half neurologists and half osteopaths, are very open to this. It's like, this all makes sense to them. There's no resistance. Mm-hmm. And I taught this last year also in Ireland and Italy, all the eyes. And so I'm really going to countries around the world where the population is aging most rapidly, like Japan, like Korea, funnily enough, and other cultures, and Spain, where we'd like to make an impact on that. Like, I don't know, I think in Japan about 34% of the population in the next 10 or 20 years will be over 65 years old. Wow. So that's so the four-day class is pioneering that, and that class I've also integrated some biocranial work, because what I found in this exploration is that when people get in tune with the biocranial rhythm, especially in the long tides, people know about that, then what happens is you work on seniors that may not be very open or excited about maybe changing their lifestyle or diet or exercise. And without even saying anything, and this is just, I've noticed, not all the time, but in a certain percentage of times, is that when people start to get in tune with that, they actually start to get more in connection with Source. And they actually realize that there's not just this kind of bounded in time and space aspect of what they're doing, but they're actually starting to look at how they're more connected to more of an eternal source, to put it that way. And when they get that experience, somehow their whole feeling about how they're going to live the rest of their life starts to change.
Oh, yeah.
And that's very exciting. I don't know if that's too esoteric, but I think that's very exciting that, you know, we've kind of heard that and found that
right.
Phenomenal to be there.
Okay, so I know you've only got a few minutes left. Michael, can you tell our listeners a bit more about how to learn more about your work? You have at least one website, or do you have two now, or how can they find out more?
I've actually shifted to one website. It was Body Energy, but for purposes of getting out in social media, my main website now is preventingalzheimers.com, all one word, preventingalzheimers.com. So people can go to that website, sign up for the new newsletter, but the main reason for cranial sacral therapists to do that is I can keep you appraised of new advances in what we're doing, and different techniques, the different things we're developing as you sign up for the newsletter. Also, it has my 7-minute TED Talk on there that I did last year, and my interview with Jack Canfield, you know, the fellow that wrote Chicken Soup for the Souls, mm-hmm. and he did a 15-minute interview with me. That's on there. And there's a lot of resources to look at video. There's one video that you can play that I have in my video section that's a 20-minute narrated video, and you can just plug and play it to a nursing administrator or somebody that takes them from soup to nuts from the very beginning of cranial sacral, so how it can apply to their particular situation. So that's a resource for people as well. And you get a copy of the book from there, or to still point inducers, just all the basic things. And then if people are interested in my cranial sacral therapy for longevity course, I'm teaching one in Toronto in September, and then probably in Salt Lake City next year. I usually do them once a year because they're my course, but UpLedger supports them as well and does the registration. I'm teaching them about once a year in the States, once a year in Canada, and then different countries around the world as well. And if anyone outside the U.S. is interested in promoting one in a country I haven't been to, I'd love to be in contact with them about that.
Great. So preventingalzheimers.com would be the main hub to go, everybody, to learn more about what Michael has been doing. Well, is there anything else you'd like to wrap up with, Michael, for our peers? Anything you want to share with them? We've got a couple minutes left.
Another new class. this has been in the back burner. It's called Cranial Sacral Therapy and Vedic Knowledge. So having been a meditator for doing TM, Transcendental Meditation, for 40 years, then teaching Cranial Sacral for 20 years, I thought, besides working on all the suffering and Sturm und Drang, you know, maybe there's cranial sacral class that can actually help promote some aspects of enlightenment.
Great.
So what I'm designing in cranial sacral therapy and Vedic knowledge is using a lot of the cranial techniques, including biocranial, and saying what could give rise to certain key aspects or experiences of enlightenment. It would be like an enlightenment sampler. Like, what is the experience of infinite silence or infinite correlation or what we call soma or what we call the different aspects of expanded awareness? And I've wanted to do this for years in developing that class as well. So that's just exciting as the work progresses.
Wow, you cover a very wide range of interests with the work then, like many of us do.
Yeah.
Okay, Michael, thank you so much for taking time to visit with me. Thank you for your ongoing, focused, patient work with this aspect of our health as we age. I'm sure it's going to go on to help many, many more people. It's very inspiring to see you doing this.
Well, and thank you for having me. It's really not a one-person thing. This is really a team effort. And it's the collective consciousness of all the therapists that is moving this forward. So I absolutely invite everyone's participation. You can email me at michaelm@bodyenergy.net. Let me know if you'd like to help in some way or get involved, because we're shifting a whole paradigm, and it's a pretty big thing. And every one of you that helped makes a difference. So I want to thank everyone that's been involved in this already and everyone that may be interested.
That's michaelm@bodyenergy.net, correct?
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, there we go. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Michael Morgan. One of the things I've always respected about many of the people in leadership positions at UpLedger Institute is their focus on efficacy and practicality and their willingness to jump through the hoops to get some research projects put together. So Michael's a great example of that, really putting your money where your mouth is and trying to bring this work to a whole population of people that can really benefit from it. So check out his site at preventingalzheimers.com and check out the page notes for this episode, and there's some links there for you too. And we'll be back pretty soon with some more for you.